Okay, this is side two of session number 45, recorded on June 25th, 2007. And I was just going to define mythic stage, my phrase, mythic stage. You can find this in the memo to Prince Charles. The definition is in that little document that's in the booklet for Bosnian Ecology, their first album. Anyways, mythic stage is defined as any mix of technologies, artifacts that you use and favor and maybe are biased towards or have an uncanny desire for or addiction to. So you look around at what a person, what technologies they rely on, and that becomes what they, that becomes the source of their values and what they argue for. So that's the meaning of mythic stage. So you have different technologies emphasized, not necessarily needed, but emphasized in the perspectives of Thompson, LaRouche, Croker, and McLuhan. Now, what's interesting is they're all tactile, and I found a part in the quote that we just did from LaRouche that shows this. Remember how we talked about your point in LaRouche is that the individual is the source of creative discovery. But he says, a little further down into the quote, it's at the second last paragraph, it's at the bottom of page 78 of my book, he says, although creative work is uniquely individual in those respects, it is the most social of all activities. The development of the mental processes in preparation for creative work is entirely social. Not only are the actions impinging upon the individual's development social, do that again, not only are the actions impinging upon the individual's development social, but the content of this influence reflects the internal geometry of society. He's saying the medium is the message here. The internal geometry of society, which is the assumptions and effects of the ideas of that time, they are what the individual's development grows out of.
Mm-hmm.
So not only are the actions impinging upon the individual's development social, but the content of this influence reflects the internal geometry of society. Well, the content of this influence reflects the form of the society, which would be the internal geometry. So he's saying the medium is the message, but using the word content to distract you from that. If you think of McLuhan as not emphasizing the content, but LaRouche's definition here, the content reflects the internal geometry. That's the old Stoic idea of the Logos, determining the mind of the tribe. The medium is the message. You know, that was the original philosophical form of it. So the
thinking of the medium of the world of ideas as opposed to the medium of the world of sensory impressions.
Right, but why say it's social then?
Well, because we come together and we I give you my new discoveries, my new ideas, and then.
But they're based on technology, which is the sign that you're developing.
Yeah, so it's all tangled up.
Yeah, it's all tangled up, and that's what I'm saying is that he's in the interval, oscillating back and forth, pretending to be different from McLuhan. So let me say, continue with what he says here. In fact, see if you can find, whether it's ideas or material technology, or both, and then following. In fact, it is to the extent that the individual apprehends his experience in just such terms that he's orienting the results of his experience for fruitful creative efforts. Read that again. In fact, it is to the extent that the individual apprehends his experience, that's sensory experience, or maybe he means by apprehending, that's the idea, is to that extent.
The word apprehend implies understanding.
Right. So, in fact, it's to the extent that the individual apprehends his experience in just such terms that he is orienting the results of his experience for fruitful creative efforts. It determines whether he will be creative. Similarly, the definition of problems requiring solution is determined by social criteria. The medium determines the problems preferred, or the mythic stage, right? Which technologies need to be improved?
Mm-hmm.
And he says, so similarly, the definition of problems requiring solutions is determined by social criteria, as social criteria on the broadest scale of reference determine which hypotheses represent probable insight solutions to these problems. That's a McLuhan statement. In other words, a visually biased man interprets the solutions to our problems today with a visual bias,
mm-hmm.
which was socially determined.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, the distinctive outlook of the creative thinker is associated with the extent of its scope of reference in respect to the much greater breadth of its current relevance and its historical setting. Ah, see there, which solution is relevant? Global warming, worrying about that, is not relevant. He would say that we can solve the global warming thing with better technology.
Mm-hmm.
The conceptions, and whereas Gore seems to recommend cutting back on the technology you presently have.
Or getting more efficient technology.
Which may not be the kind of technology that can feed more people.
Mm-hmm.
The conceptions and principles of scientific work are the accumulated accomplishment of approximately 6 centuries of European progress since the early period of the Renaissance. So no retrieving anything from before then for LaRouche. And it's a medium he's talking about. The industrial and the Gutenberg medium that's accumulated for 600 years is the baggage you leap from. They have been evolved under the impact of changes in technology as such, and changes in the social relations through which technology is realized. Let's look at this, what LaRouche is saying, and what McLuhan says, and Thompson, and Croker. They're all saying, no, I'll say it this way. A human can only say the solution problem matrix in one way, just that we individually use different words to do it. We're all saying the same thing.
Yeah, but the approaches are all different, of course.
Yeah, which is the individual clothing, or mythic stage, or preferences. But the interplay between the common and the distortion in society among groups and individuals mimes the distortion of the actual brain taking in data from the world, the common data, and then his individual perceptual apparatus mutating it to his sensory mix, sensory conditioning.
Right.
So, I don't know, I just was thinking about the common. And then he says, the characteristic interchangeable terms of creative effort are, quote, universal, fundamental, and revolutionary. He's saying what I just said. They're all the same. So it's interesting where social making or difference comes from.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it's understandable if we distort our data individually in our perception, that's naturally extended broadly in the society. So, to the degree you understand that, might put you on the sidelines.
Mm. Mm. Put you on the sidelines, and in what sense?
And then you would inject and create confusion along your lines.
Mm.
But you do it with a sense of irony.
Mm-hmm.
If you understood this process. But most people are involved and concerned and don't have the detached picture. If they do have a detached picture, it may be conditioned.
Yeah. But still, the focus of the yogi, like the Croker guy, is very different if he's, you know, meditating and, you know, looking at his astral body.
You said the Croker guy. You mean Thompson.
The Thompson guy, yeah.
Yeah.
The astral body is integrated with the physical body, but Thompson's separating it out and making it special, and LaRouche is not even acknowledging it exists.
He makes something else special.
Yeah.
So technological development.
Yeah.
And McLuhan makes a kind of ironic detachment special.
Right.
As a Catholic, he's not going to be totally identifying with this world. He's not going to take it totally seriously.
Right.
That's what McLuhan says about himself occasionally when he speaks to Catholics. He said the great advantage of being a Catholic is that we don't take the world seriously, and we watch all these people running around creating weird situations because they take the world too seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And who else? So we haven't now Croker. He goes around looking for new art, new techno art. who's the newest little unique gadget inventor or artifact manipulator for art galleries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if they're truly in the gap, though, they're not really identified with what they're saying, but I think they are. I think LaRouche is identified with what he's saying.
Nah, he talks about irony in the pun, too. No, they're all detached.
Mm-hmm.
But they may not admit that in certain contexts.
No, the magician can't, you know, show you how the trick is done. Otherwise, he loses his audience.
Right. So let's go on to... I wanted to point out how you could see LaRouche describing the same thing McLuhan was describing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I guess McLuhan would say we need to understand the dynamics of the technology and how it molds groups and individuals so that the individual can develop an autonomy in his thinking, creative efforts, the same thing that LaRouche is advocating.
Yeah, so they're both in the gap between Aristotle and Plato, but LaRouche has got a Platonic bias, and McLuhan's got a Aristotelian bias.
Yeah.
Maybe they're in the gap between the left and the right hemisphere, but they each have a little bias.
Here's McLuhan on page 27 of my book at the top. He says, Aristotelian mimesis confirms James Joyce's approach, since it is a kind of recap of natural processes, whether of making sense via cognition or of making a house by following the lines of nature. From LaRouche's point of view, that's embedded in the sensory matrix too much.
Yeah, but then LaRouche admits you have to embed yourself, at least momentarily, in the sensory matrix to see if the idea that you're inventing is working.
Yeah. So they neither believe it exactly in what they're saying. Or you have to be careful. You have to read all their works to see that they cancel out whatever you thought they were saying.
Well, but they
get that? You cancel out what you thought they were saying.
Yeah. But they prescribe different programs. LaRouche wants you to use your mind in a different way than McLuhan advocates.
At least their words and semantics seem to indicate different perceptions and solutions to the creative process.
Yeah.
So let's go to the next quote, second last quote in the LaRouche section, where we have an example of a relevant technological breakthrough coming out of the lab. And that's Pons and Fleischmann's discovery and or announcement of their discovery in 1989 of the called the cold fusion technology.
Right.
And this is from, the quote is from the Executive Intelligence Review, 1991, September 13, Volume 8, Number 35. So it's 2.5 years after Pons and Fleischmann's announcement in March 89. And this is an article LaRouche titles, Aristotle is the Root of the Evil We Confront Today. Aristotle is the root of the evil we confront today. And this quote is on page 59 of that article in that September 91 issue of his weekly magazine, Executive Intelligence Review.
Right.
So you ready?
Yeah. So this starts in the middle of an idea, I guess, because it says, with that said, let's turn our memories to March 23rd, 1989.
Now, let me say this. With that said, I put this quote in that position because we've just had this long quote on the creative process. So it actually can refer to the statement he wrote 27 years earlier. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So you're reading along, and you read this long quote on the creative process we just did, and then you read this quote, and you can connect it. With that said,
yeah.
What he said in 1974,
yeah.
And that's 27 years later.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. What he's saying... You know, and 20 years later matches up with what he said earlier, then there's some universality that is consistent throughout everything that he's been saying.
Yeah, all four of the people in my book are consistent.
Yeah.
Okay, start again.
Okay, with that said, let's turn our memories to March 23rd, 1989, when two of the world's leading authorities in electrochemistry, Professors Martin Fleischmann and Stanley Pons, issued the shattering announcement that they had achieved nuclear fusion of hydrogen isotope deuterium in a room temperature environment by means of an experimental apparatus which might fit upon a kitchen tabletop. After a few stunned outcries of admiration and curiosity from some circles, the subject of cold fusion and the hundreds of cold fusion scientists have been subjected over the past 2 odd years to one of the nastiest political witch hunts in recent history. Today, nearly 30 months after the first cold fusion announcement, the findings of approximately 600 scientists working in various parts of the world is that the essential original claims of Professors Fleischmann and Pons are validated. Whatever the cold fusion experiment leads us to discover in the end, it is clear now that the cold fusion experiment is what science calls a, this is italicized, crucial or a unique quality of discovery. It is the kind of discovery which will force much of the physics textbooks to be rewritten sooner or later.
So here we have a major technological breakthrough, the real kind of science product LaRouche has been pushing for, and it gets suppressed.
Yeah. The question is, did LaRouche jump on this because it corresponded with the ideals that he's been, you know, like it made him feel, it's like, oh, hey, I've been vindicated. Look, here's, you know, but does that mean that he really proved to himself that this works, or that he just, you know, got excited because it made him feel vindicated that in apparently this problem had been solved?
Yeah, and that may be because throughout the first half of the 90s, they covered in his magazine, what was it called, 21st Century Science and Technology. He covered each cold fusion conference. I think they happened every second year. They covered them through most of the 90s, but near the end of the 90s, they stopped really pushing the cold fusion breakthrough, and they're promoting hot fusion or other older forms of fusion technology now. They don't talk about cold fusion, so they've either fallen under the ruse, the lie, the hoax that Pons and Fleischmann were frauds and it didn't mean anything, or they themselves don't understand why it didn't develop and see it's useless to beat a dead horse, or they followed the new studies and decided that, no, it wasn't as real as we thought. So I don't know. I don't know why they play it down now. I haven't asked them.
Yeah. 600 scientists all apparently validating these experiments in their own laboratories. I don't think that could be suppressed.
Ah, well, that's what happened was that Japan got behind Pons and Fleischmann, set them up in France. And in the early 90s, they got them to do and develop it. And that development, and that lab work was supported till like 94, 95. And then in 97, August 97, a New York Times article announced that the Japanese government is not funding cold fusion research anymore. And the New York Times article did not tell its readers that the reason they're not funding anymore is that they're happy with the proof of it, and they've turned it over to corporations to develop it and sell it, because governments don't get into that kind of business, at least not in Japan. So that's the big story, is that Japan is buying up stocks of palladium and platinum to prepare to cash in on the marketing of the technology. And conspiratorial thinking would notice that in later in 97, after that incomplete New York Times article came out, the Japanese economy crashed. Was it nuked, metaphorically, because they were starting to move into cold fusion, developing it corporate, you know, on a corporate level?
That's a deep thought.
Yeah, or they don't want to promote it yet themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So the there are many scientists who proved it all over the world, and the Japanese scientists were some of the earliest people, and they created a government interest in it, and then the government of Japan funded it, and including maybe Matsushita, Mitsubishi, or was it Matsushita?
Mitsubishi
and Matsushita. One of those two was, I think, or maybe even Toyota, were funding the France lab work with Pons and Fleischmann. What happened to Pons and Fleischmann is that one of them was an American and either gave up his American citizenship or left because he was just sick of the political witch hunt against him. And one of them was British, and I think he's the one who said that it was suppressed because the military didn't want anybody making bombs or whatever they could do privately with the technology once they knew how to do it. It could create a problem for national security. And so Pons or Fleischmann, I don't know which one it was, it might have been Fleischmann. In my mind, it was the British guy. He's saying, this was in a Wired magazine article, if you want to look it up, November 1998, issue of Wired. They did a recap where Wired kind of corrected its editorial policy of putting it down earlier in the decade. They kind of said, no, maybe there's something here. But in that article, I think it is, Fleischmann is saying it's understandable why the Pentagon would naturally want to suppress it, because people could do things with the technology once it got out there that couldn't be controlled on a, you know, a military or destructive terrorist level.
Right.
So it'd be interesting to talk to Pons or Fleischmann now, see what they're doing.
That would be fun. Maybe through your Secret Council 10 network, you could work that out.
Yep, could do that. Now, the so we're talking, here is, so it confirms not only his Lewis's physical principles, it also confirms that there's an oligarchy suppressing stuff.
Yeah.
Another reason he writes this. Because Aristotle is suppressing this Platonic breakthrough.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so do we go on to the next quote, or I'll reread this, and is there anything more to say about it? I guess I've given enough background on it.
Yeah, go ahead and read it.
Okay, with all that we said, this whole thing about the creative process, and everything, all this LaRue stuff, with all that said, that's what is ironically useful about this quote, and why I had it start with the phrase, with that said, you know, because it kind of, we're coming to the end, so after all these 80 pages, or actually 40 pages, because it's every other page, on the left-hand side of my book, after all that, with that said, let's turn our memories to March 23rd, 1989, when two of the world's leading authorities in electrochemistry, Professors Martin Fleischmann and Stanley Pons, issued the shattering announcement that they had achieved nuclear fusion of hydrogen isotope deuterium in a room temperature environment by means of an experimental apparatus which might fit upon a kitchen tabletop. After a few stunned outcries of admiration and curiosity from some circles, the subject of cold fusion and the hundreds of cold fusion scientists have been subjected over the past two odd years to one of the nastiest political witch hunts in recent history. Today, nearly 30 months after the first cold fusion announcement, the findings of approximately 600 scientists working in various parts of the world is that the essential original claims of Professors Fleischmann and Pons are validated. Whatever the cold fusion experiments led us to discover in the end, it is clear now that the cold fusion experiment is what science calls a crucial or unique quality of discovery. It is the kind of discovery which will force much of the physics textbooks to be rewritten sooner or later. So if LaRouche is wrong about cold fusion, this shows you how transitory his knowledge is, and he's just jumping on a bandwagon. He's hoping people now don't remember he wrote that, and he's writing other stuff.
Mm, yeah.
The cynical view of what he's done here.
Yeah, on a conspiratorial note, it's interesting to note that the guy who was the publisher and editor of the Cold Fusion magazine...
Fusion magazine.
Yeah, Fusion magazine.
Started about 1975.
Yeah, but he was covering Cold Fusion, and he was...
But they had their first magazine was called Fusion.
Fusion.
In the mid-70s.
Yeah.
And then it became The Campaigner. Then it became 21st Century Science and Technology. And then there was another one called Fidelio in the 90s.
Yeah, you're talking about LaRouche. But there's a guy who...
Oh, you're talking... What are you talking about?
I'm talking about the guy who was publishing Cold Fusion magazine.
No, that's Eugene Malov.
Eugene Malov, yeah.
And it was called Infinite Energy, I think.
Right. I'm just pointing out the fact that somebody apparently killed him. So we could, you know, on a construe that as being potentially conspiratorial.
Yeah, some people think that he was murdered in London, right?
Yeah.
In the heart of the LaRouche beast.
Yeah.
Yeah, Eugene
so
Mallow.
Maybe he was getting too close to publishing the facts. Who knows?
Or maybe he wasn't killed.
Yeah, maybe it was an accident.
Yeah. He was hit. Was he hit by a car or something?
I think so, yeah.
And, no, maybe that didn't happen in London. I'm thinking of the UFO abductee guy, John whatever, the Harvard prof who wrote about
Mac? John?
Yeah, John Mac. I think he got hit by a car in London.
Yeah.
So,
Eugene Mallov was died under suspicious circumstances.
In North America?
I don't know where he was.
Yeah, okay. All right, so you're saying that his magazine...
Yeah, Infinite Energy was covering the cold fusion debates.
Right. Now, LaRouche would say that that's specializing in one particular issue, and that Eugene Mallov Eugene Mallov, the publisher of the magazine, should have been working with LaRouche and running for mayor of Boston and not just putting out a little information sheet.
Well, you know, actually this evokes something that we spoke about last week, which I find perplexing. You mentioned that Beter was friendly with a congressman who is actually involved in the presidential race right now.
Who's, oh, Ron Paul. Paul was a colleague of Beter.
Yes. And this guy believes there's no gold in Fort Knox. Now, how come a congressman of the United States is not allowed to go walk into Fort Knox and just simply verify whether or not there's gold there? Why? I mean, that seems preposterous to me that a myth like that could continue to circulate. And, you know, the place is guarded, you know, by security. So a congressman of the United States cannot actually go in and verify for himself whether or not there's gold there and satisfy, you know, either you know, and put that myth to rest. That's weird.
Well, Dr. Beter in the late 70s, early 80s, organized an investigation of the gold in Fort Knox, and I think that's where I first heard of Ron Paul, and he helped Beter, and they had an investigation. I think Beter described it in his later tapes how the politician, showed up for it. They were shown some parts of the building, and Beter ridiculed the whole procedure later. And I think he had the same experience when he was getting Congress to investigate it in the 73-74 period. I think he got two investigations going, and both of them were very superficial and not happy. But the congressman came to it, but they had to follow the protocol of the people that ran the Fort Knox or something, and it was policed in a sense.
Yeah.
So yeah, congressmen. But why do you think congressmen have power? I think congressmen have power.
Well, then why would LaRouche want Eugene Mallov to become a mayor? What power does a mayor have?
That's right. That's why is McClellan. Why does LaRouche keep telling kids to run for Congress? He props up the illusion that it's effective to go into Congress.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. He wants his moles on the inside.
Yeah, and he talks about, it's interesting, he talks about the international oligarchy and the control beyond national control by the international networks, and yet he still wants local people to get involved in local bureaucracies.
Mm-hmm.
There's a missing link there, maybe.
Mm. This was Bob Marshall interviewed LaRouche when he was in prison?
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll have to get that up on the internet so people can download that and hear it. It's very good.
Yeah, have you heard it?
Yeah.
Yeah, March 89. LaRouche was, you know, he went through a trial and found guilty, and he was put in a detention center in Alexandria, Virginia from like January 89 to May, June 89, and he was hard to interview before that. He was too busy running around doing his thing, running his empire or his corporation. And so while he sat in jail, he did over 250 interviews.
Wow.
And so I became aware of that, so I got Bob Marshall to interview him. and it was easy to get to him, and it was a long, good, in-depth two-hour interview.
So was he sitting on one side of the glass and Bob Marshall was on the other?
No, it was done by phone. You could. LaRouche was not in jail yet, but he was in a halfway house, a halfway jail called a detention center, waiting to be put in some jail. He was there for several months, and I remember the EIR, one of the LaRouche publications, announced it was like 235 interviews he did, 250 or so.
Oh, wow.
But I met one of the LaRouche people in New York when I moved here in 93, and he told me that, I asked him if he ever heard of it. He said, yes, I did hear that interview because they were all those interviews were collected, and since it was near Washington and was in their Washington headquarters, or Leesburg headquarters, something in that area, and he said he went and organized them all and put them in order or went through them, cataloged them, and he said the Bob Marshall interview was the best one, and they recommend people to hear it. They used to sort of give it out to people.
Mm.
But why shouldn't that be, since I'm the one who created LaRouche in the late 60s?
Oh, the truth comes out so late in the game.
No, it's in the Android Memes Anachrony.
Oh, yeah, like whoever read that.
Yeah, well, you can read it, but nobody's going to. That's the point, eh? There's nobody around to do anything to match with. But Licio Gelli gave me the orders. It's right there.
Oh,
66.
Really? But LaRouche is a LaRouche is unaware of your orchestration of his creation.
He's not unaware of me, but he's not fully cognizant of the gang that supported him.
Mm-hmm.
He is aware of certain Vatican support.
Yeah.
But he's not aware of the whole picture.
Well, you should have interviewed him while he was in jail so we could hear him profusely thank you for putting him in jail. Putting him in a position which landed him in jail.
In the long term, yes. I created him, and his life has turned out in the direction that I pushed him, yes. So that includes the jail period. But well, that's the lumps you take when you work with Dobbs.
Yeah.
I've taken lumps, so why shouldn't we all, right?
Yep.
Okay, so should we go on to the last quote?
Yeah.
Which is code SC. It's another Executive Intelligence Review article from June 7th, 1991, volume 18, number 22. Issue number 22, and it's called The Science of Christian Economy. So there's a reason I picked this quote to end the LaRouche section and to resonate with the rest of the book. So go ahead and read it.
Okay. The point so illustrated is that the idea...
Let me just say, see, the point so illustrated. So it's another way of saying, with that said, so the whole point of the LaRouche quotes has led to this. So the point so illustrated by LaRouche, okay,
is that the idea is not contained within the explicit communication.
That's a good one.
Mm-hmm. Rather, the communication is a more or less reliable guide as a key to a locked compartment to the secret of the message. The receiving mind does not, quote, decode, unquote, the message. Rather, the receiving mind relives, quote, unlocks, unquote, in a sense, the sequence of mental actions prescribed as the explicit message, and then in brackets, geometric construction is an example of this. It is the interior of the creative processes of mind in response to the stimulus represented by the message.
In response to the stimulus represented by the message.
Mm-hmm. Which regenerates more or less faithfully the concept which prompted the sender to compose the selected set of instructions, which are aggregately the relevant working content of the message itself. To oversimplify, without doubt, the relevant features of the process of communication are aggregatedly devised by the sender to set up the receiver's state of mind in such and such a combination of ways, thus respecting the essential idea to be regenerated in the mind of the receiver. And then italicized, the message is not the medium.
It ends with the phrase, the message is not the medium, as he turns the mic over to McLuhan.
Yeah.
Let's go back to this. It's a pretty interesting quote.
See, this gets back to this idea I was trying to express earlier, which we were kind of deliberating over. Anyway, he says that the receiving mind does not decode the message. Rather, the receiving mind unlocks, in a sense, a sequence of mental actions prescribed as explicit as the explicit message.
That's your stages of apprehension.
Well, also, like, for instance, with he uses geometric construction as an example of this. Well, see, Plato believed that these ideas were already embedded in the structure of your brain and your mind, and that they only needed to be recognized. So, like, if you start...
Recognized,
yeah. Like, he used the example of teaching a kid who was uneducated geometry. You show him a few things, and then it kicks in the cognition. The kid goes, well, I already know how that works, and then, like, he completes the picture because the knowledge is already intrinsic within his mind. So it gets back to this idea that LaRouche is recommending that we discover the knowledge that's already intrinsic in the mind, as opposed to developing knowledge that never existed. You know, it's popular knowledge, whether LaRouche agrees with this or not exactly, that Plato believed that, like, for instance, geometry, there was this experiment that he did with a kid where he believed that the kid could discover geometry on his own without being taught geometry. But by being persuaded, by giving him a couple of axioms to start with, the kid would complete the picture because the geometry is already pre-existent. It's not something that you're making up because you have a creative mind. It's something that already is true and you're discovering it. So that's what I wanted to say.
Yeah, well, when you use the word axioms, and then LaRouche reaches for his gun. He says it's the Aristotelian method to create axioms, and to reinforce them is not the right kind of education. I take it that the kid relives the process by redoing the geometric theorems, or drawing them and mapping them out, not the way Euclid did, but by doing another method that LaRouche called, constructive geometry,
mm-hmm.
constructive synthetic. He means it's not evoking axioms, it's knowing the stages that the mind went through to make the discovery that the theorem represents.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to redo the stages, and definitely requires a kid being taught, but not imposed with assumptions, but shown how to do the stages of the experiment.
Yeah. Well, if you show a kid a 90-degree angle and he's smart enough, he'll be able to figure out that the other two angles, if you put a third leg on there, turn it into a triangle, are going to be 45 degrees because they can't be anything else. Now, it'd take a pretty smart kid to figure that out on his own.
Right, so they don't need to predict what?
Mostly a kid needs to be taught that.
But right, yeah, well, they actually work out the drawing.
Yeah.
The caliper movements.
Yeah.
And they don't know where it's going to lead. So I don't know if they would want to be encouraged to predict where it's going. They have to just do the process.
Right.
And then they see the pattern. And then LaRouche says you don't get stuck on that formula or that pattern as the be-all and end-all. You go on and find other patterns. Develop other experiments.
Mm-hmm.
It's anti-coming up with axioms that you live by.
Yeah.
So LaRouche thinks that our society has all these assumptions about what is wealth and how important Wall Street and financial stocks are, and misses the obvious, which is, hey, we don't worry about the amount of money in the market. in speculative part of the economy, we have to look around and say, hey, the roads are deteriorating. There's no bridges being built or rebuilt. That's the evidence of a successful economy. So LaRouche is trying to get past the cultural baggage or cultural concepts to have a perception of what's happening right in front of you. And the principle for the perception is, hey, are we getting better technologies and are people getting healthier and are there more people?
Mm-hmm.
That's his version of McLuhan's percept.
Yeah. And the interesting thing is, which is really contradictory to LaRouche's whole program, is that the more affluent people become, the better off, the healthier they become, the fewer kids they have.
Oh, yes, but LaRouche does say that a more advanced...
See, LaRouche would have to impose a Christian ethic where you must have children. You must...
No. You know, LaRouche, he deals with that. Way back there, he wrote that that may be a paradox, but as one would assume, you couldn't get more people. But he says that the more advanced society you have, the family tends to be a smaller unit. But there can be more smaller units.
Yeah.
He says he's not for big families.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so, I mean, that's the Vatican idea. What is it? Keep them barefoot and pregnant?
Yeah.
So let's look at what he's saying here. I'm going to go back into this. The point so illustrated is that the idea is not contained within the explicit communication. That could be seen as ignore the content. The explicit communication is the content. And the idea, or maybe you would call it the archetype, is not there. It's not embedded in the sensory data input, right?
Or possibly it's intrinsic to the structure of the brain. It is something that we are bringing out of ourselves because it logically must turn out that way based on our form and function.
Okay, well, let's look at what he says. Rather, the communication is a more or less reliable guide, like our senses, only we look at reality darkly or with distortion, so it's a more or less reliable guide as a key to a locked compartment to the secret of the message. So he's saying there's something behind the communication. Now, you would say, yeah, it's the archetype that we're trying to unlock.
Mm-hmm.
So following that, he says, the receiving mind does not decode the message. Rather, the receiving mind relives, unlocks, in a sense, the sequence of mental actions prescribed as the explicit message. Geometric construction is an example of this. That's actually doing geometric experiments. It doesn't mean waiting for something to be evoked magically.
Yeah.
The sequence of mental actions prescribed as the explicit message. All right, so the point so illustrated is that the idea is not contained within the explicit communication. Whatever the axiom is that seems to come across, what seems to be said is not the issue. The issue is to redo what the statement is pointing to.
Mm-hmm.
Redo to the process that led to the statement.
Right.
So that's why the communication is a more or less reliable guide to the secret of the message. But we don't decode what you have told me. I relive what you said you did.
Yeah. Now, it is true in chemistry or biology or any of the sciences, you're going to get out your textbook, you're going to learn a little bit about the history, a little bit about the theory, and then you're going to go in the laboratory and you're going to perform the experiments. That's what a scientist does. LaRouche is talking about a different kind of science, or he's just saying that they're performing the wrong experiments. Or
yeah, well, he says, it is the interior of the creative processes of mind in response to the stimulus represented by the message. So the stimulus is the sensory level. It's not the whole deal. It is the interior of the creative processes which regenerates more or less faithfully the concept which prompted the center to compose the selected blah, blah, blah. So the processes of mind or the sequence of mental actions which regenerates more or less faithfully the concept which prompted the sender to compose the selected set of instructions which are accurately the relevant working content of the message itself. Let's look at that again. Generates more or less faithfully the concept which prompted the sender to compose the selected set of instructions which are accurately the relevant working content of the message itself. So he's saying the content of the message is a very half-successful indication of what has to be done.
Mm-hmm.
So if I tell you E equals MC squared, that's what I found out, and I'm telling you, you would say, what was the procedure you used to get to that? And I'd tell you, and then you go back to the lab and work it out, and you'd come back to me and say, yeah, it looks
like...
That's
science. That's science. We don't need LaRouche to tell you that.
Ah. Now you're, what I was trying to say, half an hour or more ago, that LaRouche is saying what we already know. He's saying very general technological liberal principles that society uses in election campaigns.
Right.
You just got that from that point.
Well, his hypothesis is the higher hypothesis, I think, is a refinement on what the average scientist is doing. I think he's trying to improve the quality of science in some way.
So why did you bellow, that's what science does?
Because what your example you just gave me didn't distinguish the scientists from LaRouche.
It didn't?
No. E equals MC squared, okay, go prove it for yourself. Well, here's what Einstein did, here, go do it for yourself. I mean, that's what a scientist does. Science is based...
But the scientist does, but the teachers don't. In other words, I tell it to you, and I tell you how to do it, and then you go and you tell these kids how to do it.
Right, and then we go, and we have, and every classroom has, 2 hours of class and 2 hours of lab, and then we go in the lab and we perform the experiment. That's how education works that way.
Okay, let's do this again. The point so illustrated is that the idea E equals MC squared is not contained within the explicit communication E equals MC squared. Rather, the E equals MC squared is a more or less reliable guide and approximation, a key to a locked compartment to the secret of the message. And the secret of the message is you go redo it to find out how I got the E equals MC squared. The receiving mind does not decode the message. You do not decode the E equals MC squared.